Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 177. Thank you so, so much for listening. Buiti Binafi and bienvenidos, bitches. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight white men.
What? Now,
would you believe it, girls? There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out, because if you haven't guessed, the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
And we love her so much for it. She's the best white lady you'll ever meet, I'm telling you.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is FruitloopsPod.com. We use FruitloopsPod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become Fruit Loops Patreon. You can also support us by supporting our sponsors.
Please do.
Now, before we get into it, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Well, today we're talking about Stephanie St. Clair, the Queen of Numbers, a gangster, civil rights advocate, fashionista, and businesswoman.
Yes, love it.
Yes, not technically a serial killer, but she may have killed some folks. But anyway, this is going to be a little bit different and maybe more of a fun one,
I'll say.
Yeah.
But before we get into the fun, how you doing?
I'm all right. I mean, it's November 8th. It's election day. So I'm a little anxious.
Yeah, I'd say little is an understatement. But it is election night, and I've been distracting myself with things that make me laugh, specifically children's shows, one of which I will shout out at the end of the episode. And also working on the pod has kept me busy, so that's also good.
That is good. Yeah.
Yes, yes, ma'am. Well, look at that. It's listener letter time.
Well, hello, angels.
Oh, there
Thank
they are.
You.
Look at that. Oh, hi, what's in that bag, Beth?
Well, guess what's in the bag? Guess. Just guess.
Oh, I don't know. Might it start with a P and end with an Atrion?
Yes, that's all that's in the bag, because we don't have any listener letters.
Well, that's plenty, I will say. We do have two new Patreons. They are Chrissy B., a returning champion, and Renata T, Hip Hop Air Horns.
Yeah.
We love our returning champions. We don't cut off the shout outs with when you, if you have to take a break and come back. We totally understand. So every time you come in and say, hello, we're here to support you via Patreon, we got a little tune for you. So Renata, this is for you. I see him looking a mile away. We love Renata. Can't see your face. We gotta thank you. That's what we say. My back is aching. My back's too tight. My booty shaking from left to right. Thanks, Renata. this one is for you, Chrissy B. I'm wanting every party. Soon as I get in this party, I'm gonna let go of this party. I'm gonna love fruities. Nobody can judge me but me. I was born free. I'll drop it like a Chrissy, drop it like a Chrissy. I said I drop it like a Chrissy, drop it like a Chrissy. You bad. I said now pop it like a Chrissy, pop it like a Chrissy. I said now pop it like a Chrissy. Yeah. So those are your tunes. And I hope you like them because I had fun doing them. One more hip hop air horn for y'all because we appreciate you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're going to take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
If you don't mind, Beth, I would like to get into your business. not in an inappropriate way, but just for this, just for the purposes of this. Now, tell me, how is your social battery right now, friend? Are you drained or bursting with energy?
Definitely not bursting with energy.
Okay, noted.
I got so much going on right now that my battery is running pretty low.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, Beth, you know what? I'm not a therapist, but I definitely, yeah, it's crazy, but I play one in my mind. And you are not alone. Sometimes our batteries can become drained.
Yeah, for sure. And it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And everyone is different. Some people thrive on socializing. Other people like me need more alone time. And therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Yes. Now, can I get an amen? Everybody!
Amen!
Thank you! Now, for me, therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and, you know, how to set boundaries and what to do when they're violated.
Right.
You know, it's life-changing.
Yeah.
Therapy is empowering and can help you become the best version of yourself. You know, whether your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Yes, it is all of those things. And all you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/fruit.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
All right, we're back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Our subject today is Harlem legend Stephanie St. Clair, who led a Harlem gang in the 1920s and ran a Harlem numbers business.
Oh, St. Clair. So Madame St. Clair, she had many AKAs, including Queenie, Madam Queen, Madame St. Clair, and Queen of the Numbers and Harlem's Trap Queen. And I just made that up. Now, regarding the people's lives she took, it's hard to nail down any stats since we don't she didn't technically kill anyone herself with her bare hands. But she's got the kind of stats I love to talk about. You know, was she a smart black woman ahead of her time? Yes. Was she a bad bitch? Yes. Did she not take any mess from anybody? Absolutely not. And was she an advocate for her community? Fuck yes. And did she order soldiers to kill people? Maybe. Did they deserve it? Who's to say? Anyway. Now it's time for the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the setting is Harlem, New York. And we've talked about New York a number of times before, but it's worth reminding that the land where Harlem sits was not, get this, originally inhabited by Europeans. Can
Santa
you believe it?
Maria, no! Oh my God.
Before it was colonized, the area that would become Harlem was inhabited by a Native American people, the Wekweskeek. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, but they were dubbed Manhattans or Manhatto by Dutch settlers who, along with other Native Americans, most likely in the Lenape, occupied the area on a semi-nomadic basis.
So the colonizers were like, you know what? It's just too hard to pronounce. So mm-hmm. we're just going to call you John, yeah. essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Harlem was settled by the Dutch in 1658 and named after the city of Haarlem in the Netherlands.
There's two A's in that.
Yeah. Harlem. So during the American Revolution, the British burned Harlem to the ground. Of course they Yikes. Did. As a result, Harlem grew more slowly than the rest of Manhattan during the late 18th century.
Starting in 1868, after the American Civil War, Harlem experienced an economic boom. The New York and Harlem Railroad, as well as the Interborough Rapid Transit and elevated railway lines, helped Harlem's economic growth as they connected Harlem to lower and midtown Manhattan.
During a large influx of poor European immigrants in the late 19th century, the white middle class began to flee Harlem. By the early 20th century, Harlem was the destination for migrants from all over the country, attracting both Black people from the South seeking work and an educated class who made the area a center of culture as well as a growing Black middle class.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, was established in 1909 in New York City by Black and white activists, partially in response to the ongoing violence against Black Americans around the country. It is America's oldest and largest civil rights organization.
Yeah, it's interesting the entities in the United States that were created to combat sort of white domestic terrorism, but they don't really acknowledge that. So the NAACP is very honest about that. But the Department of Justice, I learned, was created to fight the Ku Klux Klan and their violence. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of other American institutions that were sort of created to maybe we should do something about this. Yeah. So during World War I, the migration of laborers from Europe virtually ceased just as the demand for unskilled industrial labor for the war effort rose. So many Black people arrived during the First World War looking for work. And in 1910, an estimated 22,000 Black people lived in Harlem. There is a rose in Spanish Harlem. And by 1920, there were 84,000. And by 1930, about 190,000 Black people lived in Harlem, many of them fleeing Jim Crow violence from the South and seeking economic opportunity in a phenomenon called the Great Migration.
After the end of World War I, many Black soldiers who fought in segregated units such as the Harlem Hellfighters came home to a nation whose citizens often did not respect their accomplishments or aspirations for a better life for themselves and their families. They were met with extreme racial violence and threats of racial violence. According to some accounts from Black servicemen, they felt safer in combat war zones than in their own country. That's sad.
Well, yeah, that's America.
Yeah.
But that's one thing that Black people have fought in every conflict since before America started, because it's a country worth fighting for. The ideals are worth fighting for. So that's why so many Black people and BIPOC people and oppressed people continue to serve this country. Race riots and other civil uprisings occurred throughout the United States during the Red Summer of 1919, when white supremacist terrorism and racial riots occurred in more than three dozen cities across United States.
But during the Great Migration, Harlem attracted an eclectic mix of Black educated scholars, entrepreneurial business owners, passionate activists and inspired artists. Harlem underwent a historic transformation during what is now called the Harlem Renaissance, launching an explosion of Black art, music, literature, and politics. Mm. This changed the white default American image of Black people from rural and undereducated to one of urban, cosmopolitan sophistication.
Yeah. And I remember, I'll never forget reading about the Harlem Renaissance in a history book, and the paragraph was basically as long as the one you just read.
Oh, God.
And that was it. But we're going to get into it a little bit more, but it's such a fascinating time in American history. So the Harlem Renaissance was an explosion of culture, redefining how America and the world viewed American Black people. This new identity led to a greater social consciousness, and Black people became players on the world stage, expanding intellectual and social contacts internationally.
Harlem thrived as a cultural hub for Black people. Artistic Black people from all over the country flocked to Harlem, where their creativity was fostered. And leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois worked to ensure that Black Americans got the credit they deserved, enabling the community to develop a collective identity.
Prior to the Renaissance, if Black actors appeared on stage, it was in a minstrel show, musical, and rarely in a serious drama with non-stereotypical roles. In 1917, several stage plays were performed featuring Black actors and conveying complex human emotions. What? A revolutionary. Rejecting
That's crazy.
I can't believe it. Rejecting the stereotypes of the blackface and minstrel show traditions.
The visual arts were never very welcoming to Black artists. Art schools, galleries, and museums shut them out. Sculptor Meta Warwick Fuller, a protege of Auguste Rodin, explored African-American themes in her work and influenced Du Bois to champion Black visual artists. Aaron Douglas, often called the father of Black American art, adapted African techniques to create paintings and murals, as well as book illustration.
I love that. In 1919, Jamaican-American poet Claude McKay published his sonnet, If We Must Die, responding to the wave of white-on-Black race riots and lynchings following the conclusion of the First World War after Black veterans returned home expecting respect and, at the very least, tolerance. But they did get it. In fact, some Black servicemen were getting together and saying, don't go anywhere in your uniform because people are going to lose their minds.
Wow.
So anyway, Langston Hughes, a Black LGBTQ American poet who viewed writing as a way to, quote, express our individual dark-skinned selves without fear or shame, unquote, famously wrote about the period that, quote, the Negro was in vogue, unquote.
Hmm. The Harlem Stride, or just Stride, was a new way of playing the piano derived from Kansas City jazz and an extension of ragtime. The tempo was considerably faster than ragtime and harmonically more adventurous.
So at rent parties, a practice in Black communities to help Black community member who maybe needed money to pay their rent, is where pianists competed with one another and attempted to outplay each other. And rent parties didn't always have pianists. Sometimes it was just music and dancing. But at these parties, attendees paid to be present and witness these cutting contests where the pianists were dueling each other.
It kind of reminds me of rapping. You know, those rap battles.
And culturally, it makes sense. This sort of challenging skills,
A competition of skills. Yeah.
There we go.
Very cool.
Trademark that shit.
With groundbreaking new music came a vibrant nightlife. The Savoy opened in 1927, an integrated ballroom with two bandstands that featured continuous jazz and dancing well past midnight.
Oh.
The Cotton Club was one of several white clubs catering to white people only, who wanted to experience Black culture without actually having to socialize with Black people.
it's really
so
a
ridiculous.
Wild notion. It's a wild notion.
Fucking
but throughout,
ridiculous.
It makes sense. The Cotton Club is just a mini version of schools and workplaces where, you know, black, white people don't really can sort of get a little bit of blackness, but not too much. You know what I mean?
You don't want too much.
We don't. Yeah.
We just want to watch them. Yeah. We just want to observe them like they're in a zoo. You don't actually want to socialize.
Exactly. And meanwhile, to survive, BIPOC people and black people have to know everything. We know white people better than white people know themselves.
I bet you do.
To survive.
Yeah.
survive. So I just think that's interesting that was spelled out with the cotton, when referring to the Cotton Club.
Yeah.
So some of the most celebrated names in American music regularly performed in Harlem, such as Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Bessie Smith, Fats Waller, and Cab Calloway, often accompanied by elaborate floor shows. Tap dancers like John Bubbles and Bilbo Jangles Robinson Bojangles were also popular. That's a throwback for Fruit Loops fans. However, the coveted performers were not allowed in the front door or to use the facilities in these white clubs. So entertain us, but still don't get too close.
But stay out of our stuff.
Yeah. Stay out of our way.
Don't actually come near us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Josephine Baker, an American dancer, singer, and actress, was a major fashion trendsetter for both black and white women.
Mm.
Baker became known for the large hoop earrings that she regularly wore.
Hello.
And her gowns from French fashion designer Jean Patou were much copied, especially her stage costumes, which Vogue magazine called startling.
Oh, you mean you noticed my beautiful black body in this beautiful, amazing fashion?
Startling.
Wow. Thank you. So she performed the Danse Sauvage in Paris, wearing a costume that consisted of a skirt made of a string of artificial bananas. Her success, I love it. I love the it reminds me of burlesque, which is something I'm planning on getting into. And burlesque is really, it's a mockery. It's just making fun of the ridiculous. And I love that.
Yeah. And Minnie put a picture of her in the script, and it's really cute.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because the racist trope is that black people are like monkeys, right? And so if I'm dancing beautifully and in a sexy manner with artificial bananas, it's a big fuck you to racism. Yeah. If you ask, I mean, don't you think?
Yeah. I didn't think of it that way, but yeah.
Yeah. So her success coincided with the exposition des arts décoratifs that gave birth to the term art deco, and also with a renewal of interest in ethnic forms of art, including African.
Jazz dance was also an invention of the Harlem Renaissance. Jazz dances of the 1920s, like the Charleston, popularized worldwide by Josephine Baker, evolved into swing dances of the 30s, like the Lindy Hop. These were vibrant, energetic social dances, the likes of which the world had never seen before. Which is true.
Yeah, it's
I mean, you're going from the waltz to like dancing these crazy dances, crazy kids.
Well, yeah, and it also speaks to the level of freedom that black people have.
Oh yeah.
You know, black people have always danced, right? I mean, we really can't help ourselves. And on the plantation, black people would dance on cue because white, their masters would make them do it. But also there was a form of dance that black people do making fun of white people, but the white people didn't know that they were making fun of them. And so just with the opportunity to be free, look what we can do.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the progress, right? We're progressing. We're getting better. Both symbolic and real during this period became a point of reference from which the black community gained a spirit of determination that provided a growing sense of both black urbanity and black militancy. That is not a bad thing, by the way, as well as a foundation for the community to organize, build upon for the civil rights struggles in the 50s and 60s.
It was solidly within the Harlem Renaissance that today's subject built her business, the numbers game.
Mm.
The numbers game, also known as the numbers racket, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery played mostly in poor and working class neighborhoods in the United States. It's also called the policy racket, the name policy based on insurance, which is also a gamble on the future.
Yeah. And interesting to me is that like rich white people don't play the lottery.
Right.
But everybody I know plays a lottery.
Does. Yeah.
Yeah. So before the government took over the lottery in America, numbers running was a way Black people gambled in America. It created an entire underground economy in which women, particularly women of color in America, could participate in making money.
Within this underground economy, in Harlem in particular, the money made would be stored with Black banks, and Black people could enjoy having fun gambling while also banking within their own community. It's similar to the legal lottery we play today, wherein a bettor attempts to pick numbers that match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. And hey, I just bought a Powerball ticket yesterday.
Hey, man, girl, I bought one every day this week.
Yeah,
the payout is $1 billion. That's serious money.
It's up to $2 billion now.
Whoa, but if you cash out, you get $1 billion in your bank.
Yeah.
Hello.
I mean, yeah, you really... I mean, even if you lose, it was worth the shot, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
So back in the 1920s, it could cost as little as a penny to bet on these, in these numbers.
You can't win if you don't play.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yep. It's true.
So in Harlem in particular, a player picked a set of three-digit numbers between 000 and 999, and the winning numbers were drawn from the New York Stock Exchange and sometimes horse races. There's a whole formula. It's very complicated. Google it if you're curious. Google is free.
The Harlem numbers game depended on several people. There were the bankers, clerks, numbers runners, and players. For Black people, it was work and play at the same time. So if you won some money, you could use it to do something fun, pay the bills, or take care of your family.
Yeah. The numbers game helped finance Black enterprise and support Black community reinvestment. Not to mention, Black people had limited options for employment, which were often domestic or agricultural or service work. And the numbers game was
not fun work.
Not fun work. Oh my God. Yeah, no. Not the most desirable
not in any
jobs.
Way, shape, or form. Yeah.
Right. And then little chance to improve or
get out and
try something else. Right.
Yeah.
So the game was just another option for them.
Anyway, gamblers place bets with a bookmaker or bookie at a tavern, bar, barbershop or hair salon, social club, or any other semi-private place that acts as an illegal betting parlor. Numbers runners carry the money and betting slips between the betting parlors and the headquarters, called a numbers bank.
The New York white mobster and racketeer Dutch Schultz reportedly rigged the system by betting heavily on certain horse races to change the numbers that determined the winning lottery number. This allegedly added 10% to the mob take. Initially, the mob wasn't interested in what was going on in Black and brown neighborhoods, and eventually, he became a problem for the madame.
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, all of the 13 original colonies at one time or another operated legally run lotteries. Didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah. Over the years, though, the scandals and cheating that became associated with these lotteries caused officials to enact anti-lottery laws.
Cheating is really interesting when you look at it from an American lens, because I'm watching the election results and looking at these redistrict drawings.
Oh, yeah.
You want to talk about cheating? Oh, boy. Oh, boy. So it's been reported that by the mid-1920s, 30 policy banks were operating in Harlem, and each operation employed 20 to 30 runners, so upwards of 900 people. By 1931, big-time numbers operators in Harlem, aside from Stephanie St. Clair, included James Warner, Casper Holstein, Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson, Wilfred Bunder, Jose Miro, Joseph Eason, Maz Joe Eason, and Simeon Francis. The game survived despite periodic police crackdowns.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. a new podcast from Crowd Network.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
So now we're going to get into the early life of Madame St. Clair. What do you got, Beth?
Stephanie St. Clair's date and location of birth are not clear. She was born around 1890 in French Guadeloupe, formerly the French West Indies. Some sources say she was born in Martinique. Others say France. Either way, she was born at a time when Black people and women were not formally educated or well off economically, and she was one of four children.
The historical dispute over her early life and conflicting accounts are either due to lack of diligence on the part of journalists at the time, or for whatever reason, intentional misleading by St. Clair herself during later interviews. And I one source said she was doing interviews from her jail cell at one point.
Oh, wow.
It dressed up all fancy and stuff. So maybe she thought it was more glamorous to have been born in France. After all, this was during the Harlem Renaissance. And flash and glamour were admired.
Yeah, I can see that. There is surviving documentation of her travels and a marriage, but that documentation also contains conflicting information. Most of what we know about Madame St. Clair is information that she provided.
And I love that aspect of her existence. She's like a Beyonce. Oh my God, this revelation has changed my life. She's like a Beyonce. There's one interview of Beyonce where she's basically interviewing herself and answering her own questions. And it's one of my favorite Beyonce interviews. It's like that. So on July 22nd, 1911, she is in the ship's manifest as having boarded the SS Guiana from Guadeloupe and arrived in New York 9 days later. From there, she traveled to Terrebonne, Quebec, a suburb of Montreal. The ship's manifest listed her as a servant.
She was married in 1915 to George Gachet, an immigrant from Dominica, who petitioned for naturalization in 1928. He was an elevator operator or engineer, as well as a social activist who worked in New York and legally married St. Clair at Benedict the Moor Catholic Church in New York on January 6, 1915.
One biographer says she was born December 24th, 1897. Other biographies give her birthplace as Martinique and some as France. St. Clair herself insisted her birthplace was in France. Her birth year is sometimes listed as 1897. With so many things unknown or unclear about her, what is known for sure is that she was able to read and write in both French, English, and she spoke Spanish as well. She was fashionable, intelligent, and educated. A woman in total control of herself. She was a drag queen. And for you white listeners, OLB, Original Lady Boss, which is a new one for me, but I'll take it. Now, let's get into the timeline. Hit it, Bev.
Sometime in the early to mid-1920s, St. Clair separated from George. It's unclear why or exactly when. Around this time, according to one biography of her, she also became a leader of a local gang, the 40 Thieves, that ran extortion and theft schemes. But we couldn't really find confirmation of this.
St. Clair was successful at the time in a lawsuit against a former landlord who illegally evicted her from her apartment. She got $1,000 compensation, which in today's dollars is about $15,000.
Wow.
And yeah. Oh, wow, indeed.
Yeah.
She used that compensation as part of the capital needed to venture into the numbers game.
Whether it was by these means or by running her own crime gang called the 40 Thieves that ran extortion and theft rackets, somehow she accumulated a large nest egg. And St. Clair then invested $10,000, about $174,000 in today's money, to develop her own numbers game in 1923, becoming what was then called a policy banker.
I love this.
Yeah.
She's my hero. So in Playing the Numbers, Gambling in Harlem Between the Wars, authors Shane White, Stephen Garton, Stephen Robertson, and Graham White argue that the numbers game was, quote, the black business, end quote, of the early 20th century. Cosmopolitan black communities across the country, from Chicago's South Side to Harlem, played numbers in different ways. The game was massively popular all across northern cities.
This was at a time when black Americans were often denied bank loans, were even denied access to banks at all, and they were skeptical of white-controlled banks. I wonder why.
Yeah. Gee!
According to Stephen Robertson, the illegal numbers game or policy was, quote, akin to putting money in the stock market. Many saw it as an investment, and it was often just as risky as putting money in the stock market back then, unquote.
Throughout Harlem, Stephanie St. Clair was referred to as Madame St. Clair, the Grand Dame. She was on the level of Madame C.J. Walker, who was America's first black female millionaire. And she made her money off of selling hair products to black women. And in the rest of Manhattan and other city boroughs, she was referred to as Queenie. This is Stephanie St. Clair.
Yeah. St. Clair was outspoken, taking out full page ads in local newspapers, expressing her thoughts and views. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also hear me. She also had a potty mouth, which I love.
She spared no expense in advocating in the press for immigrant rights, explaining voting rights to her community, and speaking against police brutality.
By the way, in black pop culture, you can see sort of examples of Queenie in The Wiz, which is aka the black version slash better version of The Wizard of Oz. And that's an example of Queenie St. Clair. And Madame St. Clair was also portrayed by Cicely Tyson in the movie Hoodlum. And finally, they must have been listening to us because there are grumblings of an HBO project that is in the works, out of the works. Anyway, somebody seems to be working on something at HBO about this woman. So,
yeah, yeah. Madame St. Clair was the high priestess of petty.
Hello.
One of the ads that she took out in the paper was addressed to potential suitors and directed them to, quote, please not annoy me. I, Madame St. Clair, am not looking for a husband or a sweetheart. If you do not stop annoying me, I shall publish your names and letters in the newspaper. Unquote.
I love it. I love a good like drag and a
sassy.
Fuck you in the news. Oh my God. How did she do that? Madame St. Clair, will you adopt me? So Madame St. Clair clearly, LOL, had no time for anyone's nonsense. Not today, Satan. And although she expressed no interest in partnering romantically with men, she did make use of male protection for her business.
There was actually another entrepreneurial black woman running a numbers game from her home at the same time, Alberta Green. She was described as being in her 40s at the time and was known as the policy queen of South Jamaica.
Okay. Now, unlike St. Clair, though, Green was actually running her business by herself without the help of any male protection, no soldiers, no police payoffs, no organization. Yeah. And instead, she turned her home into an armed fortress guarded by numerous bolts and locks on each door and by two ferocious police dogs in the rear.
That sounds scary.
It does. It does. It sounds like she built her own prison, too.
Yeah, it doesn't sound healthy or fun.
It's what's that white guy who invented planes who started peeing in jars?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's his face? Good old what's his face?
I don't know. Leonardo DiCaprio played him in a movie.
Yes.
But
in the Aviator. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what
I can't remember his name. But yeah, it sounds miserable.
Yeah.
Yep. Ultimately, that led her business to fail as she was turned in by informants and her home in Jamaica, Queens was raided by police. She was arrested in 1935 during a crackdown on vice led by religious and community leaders.
These kinds of businesses were sometimes the only ventures that women, and especially Black women, could go into at the time. Any type of formal business or career track was generally male-dominated.
Acceptable career paths for men like factory work, office work, management, business ownership, political positions, etc., you know, were deemed unacceptable for women at the time. Some might argue to this day as well.
Well, all voting in favor of the truth. So any woman attempting to go through traditional routes to pursue these kinds of jobs would have been blocked from doing so. So if a woman wanted to support herself through any means other than domestic servitude or becoming a wife or a mother, get that MRS degree, y'all. There were very few options.
Some of these options at the time were sex work, spiritualism, which were tarot readings, palm readings, contacting the dead, stuff like
Call
that.
Call me for your free reading, Miss Cleo.
Miss Cleo, yes.
You're free reading now. Yeah, man. Did you know her accent? She's fake. Her accent is fake.
Yeah.
Yeah. She wasn't a real psychic and she wasn't a real Caribbean woman. Okay. I said it.
She's trying to, you know.
She's hustling. She's trying to earn that money.
Yeah.
I can't be mad at that.
Yeah. Or running numbers games, all of which were referred to as informal work.
That's insulting. How dare you?
Yeah, that's very insulting.
How dare you?
Fuck you.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Sometimes.
Why am I laughing?
I don't know, because we would be sobbing if we couldn't laugh.
True.
Because it's just the way of the world. And we have to work to change it for the next generation. Yes. Right?
Yeah. One would hope.
Yes.
Oh man, it's election day.
It's gonna be should we stop for a breathing exercise or a meditation exercise? Okay.
All right. Women also worked as employees at numbers banks. During her teenage years, singer Ella Fitzgerald actually worked as a Harlem numbers runner.
Oh my god, I've been working I love this because I've been working on my Ella Fitzgerald scatting. Skip it up a dab 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 Anyway, I love that. Anyway, turns out even the informal work was male dominated. Shocking. St. Clair got through it by payoffs and by partnering with male bosses, quote unquote. They like to be called that, for protection. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, male domination of the numbers game extended to players as well. While perfectly acceptable for male of any race to gamble, whether legally or illegally, Black women who indulged in this were often considered addicts. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah. Who were sacrificing their family's financial and spiritual well-being in favor of this menace to women's virtue and womanhood. Lord. Oh no. Child, Father God, please cast out these money laundering, gambling demons out of these women, Lord. Yes, Lord, amen.
Publications of the time indicated that Black women gamblers had no mental compass and preferred gambling over, quote, saving money for rent and food, unquote. They don't say that about the men, though, do they?
No, they do not.
Nope.
No, they don't.
Nope. Both female gamblers and females who ran gambling business were looked down upon unless they had the proper male support to do so.
Of course.
Right.
Because it is true that women are often seen as merely vessels to procreate.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not important.
Yeah. So anything else, unacceptable. Despite right. the patriarchy, Black women involved in this informal work, as they say, were able to pay medical bills, school tuition, and get their hair done and gain some kind of independence. All good things.
Yeah. St. Clair developed the first numbers bank located in Harlem. Here, she and her partners, which included Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson, made the first significant criminal fortunes in Black New York.
If you're thinking the name Bumpy Johnson, that sounds familiar. It might be because Bumpy Johnson has been the subject of character on a number of Hollywood films, including The Cotton Club, Hoodlum, which we just mentioned, and most recently, American Gangsta, where Madame St. Clair's, where's her movie? But in American Gangsta, he played the guy who Denzel Washington at the beginning of the movie was working for and right. eventually took over. But anyway, Madame St. Clair needs a movie. I need to see it now. HBO said, HBO's got the project. They just haven't put it out. So what are you waiting for?
They reported in 2020 that they had one in the works and then crickets.
Yeah. What's the deal, y'all?
Don't know. In 1930, St. Clair was said to have amassed $500,000 or about $8 million today.
Okay. Well, this is not an informal anything. This is serious capital.
Serious business. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her annual income was $200,000, and she lived in an apartment building that housed prominent members of the community, including NAACP activist Walter White, playwright Catherine Butler Jones, writer and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, and future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall.
I would have loved to be a fly on the wall on an elevator ride down
with all those people.
Down, yeah, with all of, oh my God, can you imagine? Oh my
God. It makes
me
think of Only Murders in the Building, when they're always running in.
Yes, but this is real life, like historical, like heroes, juggernauts,
right?
So initially, St. Clair had little competition except for Casper Holstein, a Black man who had developed his own lottery called Bolito. And by 1920, he became known in the New York underworld as the Bolito King.
By the end of the 1920s, Holstein controlled a massive numbers running operation, as well as nightclubs and several other legitimate business enterprises. His income was rumored to be as high as $12,000 a day at his peak.
Wow.
Yeah.
After Prohibition ended in 1932 and during the Great Depression, white New York mobsters saw their profits rapidly diminish. Prior to this, they considered the numbers racket to be small potatoes. But when they saw the profits being made by non-white folks, they decided they wanted and needed a cut.
Dixie Davis, a white attorney who often represented Black people in the numbers game, decided he wanted to take control of it, and he brought in Dutch Schultz. A Bronx native, Schultz was a notorious bootlegger with more than 100 underlings who enforced his rackets.
New York State's special prosecutor, Thomas, isn't that what Preet's title was?
Not special prosecutor, no.
Okay. Sorry.
I forget what it is. Something prosecutor, but not special.
Oh, it's not tattooed on your belly?
Not yet. But that's a good idea.
Okay, next.
Maybe right next across year. My right across my belly. So
I can hear the wheels turning in your brain. Now, New York State, you have the FBI base pillow, and then you have Preet's name tattooed across
your chest.
Yeah. So, New York, Beth loves justice, guys, and true crime. So, New York State Special Prosecutor Thomas E. Dewey viewed Schultz as public enemy number one, later writing in his autobiography that he, quote, regarded it as a matter of primary importance to get Dutch Schultz, unquote.
The Schultz gang then began a takeover of the Harlem numbers racket. Black numbers runners were not career criminals, and violence had not been a part of their trade. Additionally, Dixie Davis represented many of Harlem's black policy operators and had a strong influence over them. Dutch Schultz brought in the guns and the muscle and the political influence, which black people did not have.
Davis advised his clients that Schultz and his gang were too powerful to fight with. One by one, including Casper Holstein, they folded. But Stephanie St. Clair was a different story. She balked at Schultz's overtures, went straight to the Harlem newspapers, and took out an ad to reveal how Schultz was trying to steal her business.
I love Boom. How she just goes straight to the newspaper.
You know what? Well, and what, you know, she could have gone down too, and I think did at one point, right, for this, but fuck it. Balls to the wall, bitches. Cocks out, wangs out, suns out, guns out, buns out, all of it.
All of everything out.
Everything out.
The Schultz gang then engaged in a bloody war with St. Clair and her allies for control of her numbers business. St. Clair didn't mince words in her declaration of war on Schultz. Quote, "I'm not afraid of Dutch Schultz or any other living man. He'll never touch me. I will kill Schultz if he sets foot in Harlem. He is a rat.
Ooh.
The policy game is my game." Unquote.
Whoa.
You tell him, girl.
Okay.
You tell him.
Okay. Shots fired. Now, St. Clair moved swiftly against Schultz, organizing the remaining black policy owners in her fight against the Dutchman. She and her allies violently confronted white store owners who were collecting bets on Schultz's behalf, smashing cases, destroying policy bets, and ordering their adversaries out of Harlem. Get out of here. Get the fuck out of here. GTFOH, I think, is the acronym. St. Clair also took out ads encouraging the people of Harlem to play black and only place numbers bets with black organizers and, I think, also put their money in black banks.
Right, right. Schultz quickly retaliated. He started calling St. Clair's home to threaten her. He kidnapped and murdered her men. He even placed a contract on her life, forcing St. Clair at one point to hide in a cellar covered in coal.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Another time, Schultz sent an underling to intimidate St. Clair, but she gained the upper hand, pushed the man into a closet, locking him in and proceeding to tell her bodyguards to, quote, take care of him, unquote.
Oh, I love it. More, please. So over 40 people were killed in gangland-related violence, including the murders of Harlem numbers operators. Despite this, St. Clair and Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson initially refused to surrender to Schultz. Over time, however, their power weakened.
St. Clair made several futile complaints to local authorities about harassment from the New York Police Department, which she felt aided Schultz, and it probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Without political influence at City Hall, her concerns were ignored.
However, I got another something for you. St. Clair took out several ads in Harlem newspapers accusing senior police officers of various forms of corruption. She named them. This is their name. This is their phone number. Their kids go to this school and their address is this. And outraged by this, the police arrested her on several exaggerated, trumped up ass charges. In response, she testified to New York State's Seabury Crime Commission about the large number of kickbacks she had paid these police motherfucker dirty hoes officials to protect her operations. Her charges led to the dismissal of several police officers.
Good.
Winning!
Yeah. But as St. Clair realized she could no longer oppose Schultz, she agreed to a truce, which transferred the power and profits from her organization to Schultz and the Italian mafia headed by Lucky Luciano.
But no weapon formed against me shall prosper, because in 1935, Dutch Schultz was assassinated on the orders of Luciano. Although St. Clair was not involved in his murder, she was remembered for sending an infamous telegram to his bedside where he lay dying, which said, quote, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap," unquote. The telegram reportedly made headlines across the nation. Yeah, he messed with the wrong one and he fucked up and found out. Now, St. Clair's former Lieutenant Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson then became the mafia's representative in Harlem while she moved on to other things.
St. Clair's notoriety continued to grow even after her war with Schultz came to an end. In 1936, her non-legal marriage by contract to Bishop Amiru al-Mu'minin Sufi Abdul Hamid, an eccentric, controversial, anti-Semitic race activist, popularly dubbed Black Hitler, dominated headlines of Black newspapers across the country.
I wonder if a rapper who shall not be named has heard of this individual. But anyway, you know, the by contract marriage thing, I guess, is like a weird prenup. So she, after like 90 years or some shit, then they can split the assets. But before that time,
90 years,
before that, I guess it's each individual. It's something like that. There's like a timeline on when the assets can be split or divvied up after the marriage. So anyway, culture corner alert. The discussion of Black people and Jewish people is an old one. Both groups have been the subject of hate and terrible violence all over the world since the beginning of time. Sometimes oppressed groups are pitted against each other to their detriment and to the triumph of the nefarious oppressor. And there are Black Jewish people, which I wanted to say because I think that's important to note. There are Black Jewish people. So whatever the anti-Semitism is coming from a Black person, that should be understood. There's also Black Jewish people in Africa. Lots of them. But anyway, oppressed people do best when we work together. That's the bottom line. And 2 years ago, we should remember, because this is election night, a Jewish man and a Black man made it to the Senate on the same day. It was January 6th, but on the same day in the South. So progress like that is what I try to think of when, you know, we are faced with this anti-Black or anti-Semitism.
In their contract, the 40-something-year-old St. Clair and the 30-year-old Hamid agreed to a one-year trial period. Okay, so this is making more sense to me now. She's 40-something. He's 30.
Okay,
now this is making sense. All right.
Okay, the contract part. Okay, got it.
Or the pairing of them together. What is she doing with this dude? Oh, he's 30. Gotcha.
Okay.
If the pair decided not to continue their relationship at that point, they could terminate the contract. If, on the other hand, they remained certain of their feelings for each other, they would hold a legal ceremony.
I like this. I know it's not a common thing
in the
States.
It's not traditional.
I don't see
anything wrong with it.
Yeah. If I'm expected to marry somebody, let me just test it out, please.
Let's test it out. Yeah.
Why not? So Hamid claimed to have been born in the shadows of the Egyptian pyramids and a descendant of Egyptian pharaohs. In fact, he was likely born Eugene Brown in Lowell, Massachusetts. There are no pyramids in Massachusetts.
Eugene is not very exotic.
Nope. Eugene. So a labor activist, he advocated for Black separatism while, quote, wearing a turban wrapped around his head, a Black and crimson lined cape, a green velvet blouse, and Black riding boots, unquote. Now, Uncle Eugene is what I'm, he's giving Uncle Eugene vibes. This is Uncle Eugene, who's really, he got a big tax income check after April and went to the rainbow and got some new duds. And this is the product right here. You know the rainbow, right?
No, what's the
rainbow? The rainbow, there's every hood has a rainbow. And it is a clothing store where you can get perfume, hoop earrings, school uniforms,
everything
and the latest fast fashion.
Gotcha.
But they don't sell snacks or have bathrooms. Anyway.
Oh, okay. According to historian Murray Friedman, who wrote a book called What Went Wrong? The Creation and Collapse of the Black Jewish Alliance, Hamid, quote, courted the German-American Bund and the Nazi-like Christian Front, unquote, which is really weird.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. He organized violent boycotts of Jewish-owned establishments and advocated for businesses to instead hire Black employees.
Wow. And I will just say that this, as I said, everything works better when we all work together.
Yeah.
And the zero sum game is what has us where we are now. This idea that if they gain, I get nothing.
Yeah. Then you lose. Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't, it doesn't work for anybody.
No.
So the couple's union soon imploded. Surprise! On January 19th, 1938, St. Clair fired 3 bullets at Hamid after learning of his affair with, quote, a conjure woman from Jamaica, unquote. According to Hamid, the closest she came to hitting him was nicking his teeth. No big deal. Convicted for his attempted murder, St. Clair was sentenced to 2 to 10 years at New York State Prison.
During sentencing, presiding judge James G. Wallace said, quote, this woman has been living by her wits all her life, unquote. As St. Clair was led out of the courtroom, she reportedly, quote, kissed her hand to freedom, unquote, which I'm not familiar with that expression.
I was going to ask you what it meant.
Okay, yeah, I'm not really sure. I'm imagining her kissing her hand and then throwing
and
it up in the air.
Waving it like a, yes. like she's on a float at yes. the Macy's Day Parade.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye. But yes.
That's what I'm imagining anyway.
Me too. But somebody tell us, what
yeah,
does it
let
really
us,
mean
let us know.
If you've
yeah.
ever heard any person say that before? I am curious. Yeah.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
So now we're going to get into where are they now? Following her release from prison, the details of St. Clair's life became hazy. A 1943 article in the Black New York Amsterdam News says she visited relatives back in the West Indies before returning to live out her days in seclusion, likely in Harlem.
Historian LaShawn Harris traces St. Clair's last address to a Long Island psychiatric facility where in December 1969, she died at the age of 72 or possibly 82, depending on her true birthday. Her death wasn't widely publicized.
I thought that was interesting. She lived so long, considering in general, Black people have the time, and Black people generally, and Black women generally have shorter life expectancies than other people. And so that's a long time to live for the time.
Yeah.
So according to Harris, in her later years, St. Clair made a conscious effort to stay out of the public eye. Quote, she probably didn't go out like she wanted, or maybe she did. But she didn't die with money. She had kind of a rags to riches story, then riches to rags, unquote. And I don't know if that is, I will say sources I consulted, which were Black women sources who researched this woman, said that she did die wealthy. So
okay. And it would make sense if she died at the age of 72, if she had money, because that's, you know.
How else would she have lived, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Harris questions whether St. Clair was really all that different from other industrial titans of the era. Quote, St. Clair should be included in histories of Black business and Black entrepreneurship, unquote. And I agree.
Couldn't agree more. I've been smiling reading this entire story and talking about it with you. So I'm curious, what are your takeaways, Beth?
Well, as one judge said, she lived by her wit.
Yes.
She came from nothing and managed to get on the same level as white mobsters, which was really impressive. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She was badass and took no shit. I love that about her. Yeah. I loved how she would publish stuff in the newspaper.
I know. Yeah. It was like pre-Twitter, like the Twitter of the time, right? Before Elon Musk ruined it.
I can't help but admire her, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
She took on Dutch Schultz when the men wouldn't.
Right.
And it's kind of sad how she faded out. But I'm hoping that she did have money and she was happy.
Yeah.
Also, I loved learning about the Harlem Renaissance because I really didn't know anything about it before we started this. Yeah,
it's a really fascinating. And I think we maybe the last episode we recorded, we talked about the Roaring Twenties.
We mentioned it. We mentioned the Harlem Renaissance, but we didn't get into it. Yeah.
Right. But my point is that the Roaring Twenties are not appealing, interesting, exciting, or even like looked at fondly by Black people. But when you mention Harlem Renaissance is a part, it is its own separate thing. And that this is the part of that era that I love. And it endures to this day, which is really, really, really rad.
Very cool.
So she's my hero. I love this woman. Her style, her badassery, all of the forces were against her. There's that immigrant mentality that she's got. There's that, I don't know if you remember t-shirts from a couple of years back during the election where it was like, Black women, don't worry about it. I'll just do it. Or, that's the whole reason Joe Biden is in office. We don't love Joe Byron. Like, he's all right, but
he was
the best option. So, there's this sort of, we have to do what's best for ourselves and the collective. Right. And that's what she was all about. I love that. Because of her existence in the world as a woman, as a Black woman and an immigrant and poor initially, all those forces couldn't keep her down. And she just did the damn thing. And I love that. Love, 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 love.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
Well, y'all, if I'm being honest, it is election night.
Yep.
I had a hard time coming up with tips on how not to get murdered. I'm just trying to preserve my rights and live. So I apologize. This episode is obviously going to air after election night, but I voted to keep my rights and to keep the rights of my kids and for equity and for liberty and justice for all. I just wanted to remind people that Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor in Georgia, said, if your candidate or proposal doesn't win, you don't pack up your marbles and go home. You keep working. And we might need a minute if things don't turn out the way we wanted or hoped, and we might be discouraged. Maybe you're listening to this and you're like, yay, red wave, whatever, I don't care. You might be excited, but just wanted to remind y'all, keep going, keep fighting. This is not a perfect country, but it can be, and we fight, we rest, and repeat, and we take care of ourselves and each other in the meantime. So it just a reminder. That's all.
Cool. Thank you.
Do you have anything to add? Any, I don't know, a, tasers, weapons, any bunkers that we can purchase at a discounted price.
There might be one in, what was that bunker? Yeah.
Yeah. In Arizona. The news story. Okay. Yeah. Well, I just left Arizona, but that is a very attractive.
Come back for a bunker.
Yeah, incentive. Yeah. Totally.
I forget the name of that place. What's the name of that place?
Oh, Waddell.
Yes, in Waddell. Yeah.
Yes. Waddell. Yeah. That's where we'll all have to go. Okay, fruities? So now
we'll meet up in Waddell. There's see a bunker. There.
We'll see you there. Oh, Lord help us. So now it is shout out time, where we shout out any content by any people of color, any LGBTQ folks, any marginalized folks, really, any by or about them, or any true crime goodies. Just got two from me. Wild Crime on Hulu. Have you been watching it?
I haven't yet. No, but it's on my watch list.
Yes. Well, even old Whitey enjoys it. And so if you have somebody in your midst who's like murder show, they might like this.
Oh, okay, cool.
So me and my husband have liked that one. And then it's about, you know, murders and crimes that take place in national parks and in the wilderness. And then also the children's show that's been distracting me this evening is Wendell and Wild. And it reunites Key and Peele.
Oh, wow.
Remember?
Yeah,
and it's an animated stop motion horror comedy film about demons and the prison industrial complex.
Oh my God.
And there's, it's for kids though.
And it's comedy.
Yeah, and it's comedy. And it's really fun. And it's all the voices that grown-ups are totally familiar with. Like Angela Bassett is in it and a bunch of other people. There's the young girl from This Is Us. She's a voice on it. Anyway, it's just fun. It's just
very cool.
So what do you
right
got?
On. I wanted to shout out The Serpent Queen on Stars.
Oh.
She tells the story of her life to Rahima, a servant girl, revealing how she came to enter the French royal court at the age of 14.
Oh.
And Samantha Morton plays Catherine.
Okay.
Senia Nanua is Rahima. And I don't think I've ever seen her in anything, but I really like her.
Okay. Okay.
She's black.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Love it.
And then I wanted to say that Michael Hobbs from Maintenance Phase and formerly on You're Wrong About has a new podcast called If Books Could Kill.
Oh, I love him. And this sounds amazing. Okay.
Yeah. It's about trash books that misled us.
Oh, I love it. You know, I love the flood of people calling out and revealing misleading information.
Yeah.
It's so necessary. And so this sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
So is it out?
Yeah, there's only one episode out right now. But by the time this airs, there should be at least two, if not three.
Okay. Fantastic. So just to recap, that is Wild Crime on Hulu, Wendell and Wild on Netflix, The Serpent Queen on Stars, and Michael Hobbs's podcast called If Books Could Kill, wherever you get your podcast. Oh, man, I'm sad again.
That's it. It's time.
Give me. Oh, no. I was just going to say, I was just going to pretend I'm guzzling Zoloft so I won't be sad. Go. But you can't do that. That's dangerous.
No.
So don't do that. And I'm not a doctor, so don't listen to a word I say. Also, don't fact check me on anything. Anyway, it's the end of our show, Beth.
It sure is.
Can you remind the people where they can find us until the next time that we meet?
Sure. Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
That's right. Now, this is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time. Look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.